to the FTN Show.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined tonight by Adam Camilleri.
Hey everybody, how's it going?
And Red Powell.
Good evening.
Yo, welcome to the show, guys.
Welcome. I totally had like four or five things, silly things to say when you introduced me during the week. I was like sitting in the shower and be like, ha, I should say this week. Or ha, I should go say this one this week as I was driving in the car. And then as soon as you were said Adam Camilleri, they all left my brain.
That's right, the stage lights kick on.
It was empty. Yep, yep. Stage fright.
We are the Battle of Lost Souls podcast. Thanks everybody for tuning in. Thanks to everyone who's left some 5-star reviews wherever you can and commenting on YouTube. If you haven't already, please, you know, like, share, and subscribe. It means a whole lot. The comment section there is great. We're actually pretty interactive with them on there. So it's fun to see the discussion advance past the show on some of these platforms. Thanks everybody for joining us. On this episode, I would like to discuss we touched on something on the last show about, playing when you're down or whatever. And then we kind of glossed over a topic of how to make sacrifice plays, what to sacrifice, when to sacrifice, all that stuff, and still advance yourself towards trying to win the game or at least, not go completely belly up. And then later on, I had an interesting question get sent to me by an old friend about how to get back into the game and how to build a Black Legion army list. He really loves the Black Legion. Well, he really loves Chaos Undivided, and he thinks that Black Legion are the best Chaos Undivided. So, whatever. That's a fine stance to have. But that's what we're going to talk about today. And I guess let's start with the sacrifice plays. So you guys, known for your tabletop prowess, your tactical genius on the tabletop, and have, I'm sure, had to come up with some pretty tricky plays over the years to get those wins.
I have a specific name for what this is. I call this resource management. And you look at your army as a collection of resources. Your list is the collection of resources, your models, your rules, whatever. And you've compiled them into, a bundle of things that you have to wield during a game, going over things with a broad brush. But with the state of the game being so killy, everything just seems to kill. Like if you got a unit that's shooting at something, chances are you're going to maim it or kill it. Otherwise, you're not going to shoot at it. I suppose you get to a certain level of competence in the game where your resource management has to kind of work with the knowledge of your opponent's target priority and knowledge that you're playing at a certain level of the game, playing in tournaments or whatever. People are going to shoot the things that they're supposed to shoot. So you need to take that into account when you're playing the game, when you're building your lists, and then you need to manage your resources appropriately. Now, there's a lot of different ways you can go into managing it, but I see the two big pillars of this being either taking and spamming an option, usually that's three times unless it's a troop choice, e.g. the rule of three, spamming something so that if you lose it or if you give something up or if you have to sacrifice something, you haven't given up everything of that type of thing in your list.
Spam has a negative connotation to it. You're building,
that's very true.
But it's redundancy is really what you're doing. Is that, and there is, like, I've got this powerful thing. I'm probably going to lose one or two of them in the first turn of the game if I don't go first. I still want to be able to produce this effect. So you build that redundancy, and there's nothing wrong with either one of those approaches. Sometimes it does feel like, a little one-dimensional, or maybe you can't respect the army building brewing capacity of your opponent because it looks like they just took one thing six times, but it's still an effective thing.
And at the other end of that, when you're building in redundancy, you also might be like aiming for some kind of a critical mass. I know with a lot of what we see with Horde armies are built with the goal of reaching a critical mass of redundancy. Like, e.g., you take 300 Gretchen models. You're building enough redundancy into your army already because you're reaching a critical mass of saying, hey, I literally have more bodies than you have bullets, and it turns in the game. Now, that's one of the other pillars of it. But the second pillar was taking one thing of a thing, e.g., this was what we would associate with Death Stars, another term that has negative connotations in editions gone by. You take one of a thing and add enough resources to it, adding resources and resource management to it, that it's a secure investment. So that's things like Paladin Stars, Centurions, can be things like Knights at times, can be things like Tank Commanders now in the game. But yeah, there are things where you do have this hard cap on how many of them you can take. Like, you can only take three Tank Commanders. So you do need some level of resource management associated with it to make sure that they maintain their efficacy. But see, then there's things like when you're delving a bit deeper into Tank Commanders, Demolishers, yeah? So the Tank Commander Demolishers, they have a short range. So to get them to use their best efficacy, you need to be close enough to be hit back, essentially. If you're going to be 24-inch range, you can do things like use the Talat stratagem, use the Move, Shoot, Move, or the Destroyans to get extra range, blah, 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 blah. But essentially, what I'm talking about here is that to use something to its best ability, you have to expose it to danger. I suppose another one for you, Paul, would be Death Company. You want to throw your Death Company to the wall, turn one, full on fury, right up the grill.
Yeah, you don't want to waste probably... them. They're like a fire and forget. I mean, that's not really what they are, but that's you can easily equate them to something like that. And so since you know they're not going to be around for very long, you want them to be doing something.
Yeah, and that's the managing that resource that it's built to do. That's what it's built to do. They're built to be thrown away for the biggest optimum return for their investment. So you go in and you absolutely take out something critical to your opponent. Now, if I'm an opponent against somebody playing Death Company, and I know I'm going second, they're going to kill something. If it's anything except for like Hammer and Anvil or that other short edge deployment, there's literally not really any way that I can stop them killing something. So I need to offer something up to the Death Company gods. I need to manage my resources and say, hey, what can I afford to offer up in exchange for this Death Company? Because they're going to come in and I can't stop them doing what they want to do.
Yep.
But I can manage. I can't stop them killing, but I can manage what they kill. And I suppose that's where it comes to.
That's it. That's exactly what we're talking about. Like, so what do you do? What do you choose at that point? Let's say you don't have 60 cultists that are just designed there to set the charge. I mean, that's basically it.
Yeah, well, so I've thrown around a lot of big broad terms.
Yeah, just recapping in regards to what you guys already covered. I mean, so we talked about a little while ago about the whole redundancy deal, right? And I mentioned what I called my rule of two, like never less than always having redundancy built in for the effect, not necessarily a given unit. I mean, you can spam or what have you. But to your point, Adam, in regards of the resiliency and everything, I mean, you look at what was recently up until the most recent FAQ of what people were able to do with the resiliency and resource management of Leviathan Dreadnought in an Iron Hands army, or what Riptides can still do with Savior Protocols and drones. I mean, that kind of resiliency, you're right on it. So going into the getting the bang for the buck, right? Making sure. So when you look at it, like our game is already set up with technically value of units, right? I mean, you got point values, right? And so when you look at point values and you take a Leviathan, for example, and it's around approximately 260-ish points around that approximation. And then you look at what it's capable of enduring, or take the Centurions, right? And with transhuman physiology, and of course that you start tacking on value to CPs. But then you go to what I'd mentioned, a while back in regards of Space Marines and Berserkers. So Khorne Berserkers, and you talk about Death Company on a very similar level. Khorne Berserkers are 8 of them, approximately 138 points, I think, for 8 of them. And when you take into the value of what 8 of them can do at 138 points and they fight twice, if they're World Eaters on the charge, I mean, the amount of attacks that you're dishing out, each model starts, you know, so two, third one for Shock Assault or Hateful Assault, fourth one for being a World Eater, and then a Chainsword. So you're talking about 5 attacks per model. And then they attack twice. And of course, minus the World Eater deal, you're talking 4. So really 9 attacks per model with 2 fight phases, you know. So when you talk about what I can sacrifice, what I can afford. So look, you know, going to my LVO list, I had 3 Disco Lords. I had 3 drop. I had 3 Dreadclaws. I had 3 squads of Berserkers, and then I had a Demon Prince mashed in there. And really, but the whole thing was like what you're saying, this saturation that hordes can hit. You're talking about threat overload, right? And so you want to throw as much as you can, and something's going to get through to make kind of a connection here. It's much old school, not necessarily the most modern in regards to this, but when we looked at old Soviet Union tactics, that's what they did. They threw the kitchen sink at you, and then something was going to get through. And once it got through, it was going to exploit as deep as it possibly could and make the most out of what it could do, right? And so that's what a lot of these cases are trying to do. That's what I try to do with my Berserkers. I throw the kitchen sink at you, and I just need one of those things to get through, right? The Disco Lords or the Berserkers, one of those things is going to get through and exploit the advantage.
Well, with that in mind, do you invest any additional points past the body of the Berserker? Is there any need to do that? I know you can't really upgrade the individual units, but do you put any points into the champion? Do you have any thought to support systems for them that may not be just of the unit?
So I've played around with, and I do think that there's some value, especially with the way things are. You know, we don't have the old challenge system of 7th edition before that and whatnot. And so now your sergeants can kind of exist. They can't be called out necessarily, you know, minus a few extra rules with snipers. But so for berserkers, for example, I do give them chain swords and chain axes. And so that's one extra point per model. And when you look at the value of that, putting them a whole extra strength up and AP minus one.
Pretty good. One way I like to look at some things like sergeants a lot of the time, especially when it's a sergeant that has obviously better than the squad that they come with. I think the best example of the units that I'm using like that now is the Deathwing Knight Sergeant. He comes with flail.
Yep.
If I'm playing against the Horde army, that guy, his damage output on the charge where he gets to 4 attacks, possibly 5 attacks with the stratagem, attacking twice for who knows 10 freaking attacks, his value is the same as 4 or 5 of the knights because of the amount he kills and the way that if I'm playing against single model units, they've got they got strength 8, 3 damage weapons. Each one of those hits kills one guy, and they've got 3 attacks. He has 4 attacks. Each one of his hits can kill 2 guys. So he's effectively, for his 4 attacks, is the value of 2 or 3 of his mates. So sometimes when I'm looking at a resource that I have, those Deathwing Knights, they are, sometimes they're just 18 extra ablative wounds for the sergeant, because the sergeant's the only one I require to do the job that I need that squad to do this game. So it's just, that could be the same as your berserkers. Like, your berserkers can cop a charge from something. And let's say, they're going to kill 7 out of 8 of them, but that one champion is going to pass morale maybe and then go on a rampage. You can just be like, okay, well, they were just 7 ablative wounds this game, because all I needed was this one of that resource, this portion of that resource.
That's right.
I think a good example of that is centurions as well. Like, centurions, one centurion can kill 3 units in a turn. You could shoot down 10 cultists. So you could shoot down 10 cultists with your hurricane. You could flame down another 10, and then you can charge into a 5-man something, kill 4 of them, make the other one run away. You know, so the other 5 of them were probably just going to overkill the living crap out of those 3 units anyway, if that was everything that was in range. So technically, when you're managing your resources, you don't need the max of everything you've got. You just need the right amount to do what's required in the game.
I've become kind of instinctual over the years of that's how I build my list. You know, that whole min-max mentality of like, what do I need? Death Guard Terminators actually fit into that kind of thing. You know, they're situational, you know, where you may need the flail, you may need the other thing, or you may need the body to activate a strat or something. There's lots of things that play into that.
Well, another good example would be Dark Reapers. You know how they have their 2 modes of 5, but then they've got the Tempest Launcher on the Sarge. If you're playing against Knights, you let that Exarch go first. You do not need that Tempest Launcher that game. But in the reverse, you're playing against Imperial Guard. Your strength 8, strength 5 shots don't kill that much Guardsmen, especially when that Tempest Launcher can kill a whole squad by himself. Diversifying your... at the start of the edition, I said in a couple of podcasts that I used to be on was things with multiple profiles are always a premium. Now, that didn't hold true because things got so spammable, like because Heavy Bolters got so spammable, because blah, blah, blah got so spammable. At the onset of this edition, like, Missile Launcher is really good. We all know Dark Reapers were good and have remained good pretty much throughout the entire edition. Things with a multi-purpose are all things that are very good at doing the one thing that they do, e.g. Berserkers and Death Company. Things that let you build and invest into doing this one thing superbly well is always a good investment.
Yeah, we morph this conversation a little bit into how to just kind of get over the finish line with some of this stuff, but are you considering the warm bodies that you have to line up to make this stuff efficient part of your sacrifice strategy?
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, I think I don't want to keep this entirely within the realms of the armies that I play, but I can tell you resource management has never been more apparent for me than when I'm playing Mono Imperial Guard. So because we only literally have one unit in the entire army that's any good as a bully, or any good with any significant melee punch, being Bulgrin, and survivability. So literally every other unit in the army is probably and being very capable of being picked up by your opponent.
I know. I'm about to make a lot of people mad. I'm just gonna say that right now. In the guard, you have a select few reliable damage dealers. Mm-hmm. A lot of the other pieces in the army are meant to be. It's not filler. Yep. Filler's not the right word, but they're meant to be positional pieces, things that do stuff for you, score points or whatever, hold off the enemy. You know, they're doing lots of things other than doing damage.
Sure. They pinch hit towards the entire goal, and when used cohesively, they all work together. So one of the biggest things I was going to say was infantry squads. The amount of times in games I would double move an infantry squad to just get in the way of somebody. to like double move it because it moves in advance and it ought to move in advance again to just block somebody up. That is a complete sacrifice play.
I mean, to build on Adam's point that and kind of where you're going with the point of, I mean, you think about Nurglings, right? And like, what are Nurglings going to kill? Their strength 2, toughness 2, but their ability to get out there. Infiltrators and incursors, right? Infiltrators don't necessarily have the best guns out there, but not only are they able to infiltrate, they have that 12-inch bubble. And then so it goes back to this whole understanding of effects and what each piece of the army. So going back to your comments in regards to the IG stuff, like that's okay that different parts have different roles, right? I mean, that's exactly what battlefield roles are for. And so I think that's okay. Like it's okay for people to admit that, I mean, an infantry squad, just like what Adam was saying, like being able to move a squad into the way of something, it achieves enough, right? And so when you talk about building an army and you're, you know, where are your screening units? Where are your units that are achieving this effect and understanding that the next part we go into like these relative points and everything, we talk about sacrificing things. Everyone needs to be prepared to embrace the concept that you are going to be attrited. You are going to suffer X amount of points at some point. You're never going to, I mean, there's some armies where people can say, well, I'm going to be this durable or whatever, you know, going to the Blight Ward Terminators or what have you, but certain things are going to die and you need to know I'm going to lose this because people are going to either focus on this or I put this in the way and then I'm going to have to win with the other 1500 points in my army.
That's a very good point. And some armies have an easier time with it. Like we're talking about guard, like it's, you know, what your sacrifice pieces are. These are the resources I'm going to burn to that objective. I think it gets a little bit worse off when you're playing with things as the point value of the unit goes up. You know, like when you're looking at another 200, 300 point unit that you have to willingly have it sit around and do nothing or get fed into a meat grinder, you start to question your decisions. Is it the right play?
So there's a concept called win condition. And I'm sure this is something that's not unfamiliar to Red, especially just with military heads and military minds. There's the objective you need to secure in order to win the game, win the mission. Usually missions are all centered around points, but a lot of the time with, like, I keep coming back to how killing the game is. A lot of the time it's stopping a key component of your army, of your opponent's army doing what it wants to do. And that is your win condition. Because if it's let loose, it'll wipe you or cripple you or deny you being able to achieve what you want. For a lot of things, it's like Centurions, it's Leviathan Dread or the infantry that supply the Leviathan Dread. It's drones. So like killing all the drones in a tower, in first tower is usually the win condition. If they have no drones by turn 3, usually you've got enough time left to then kill broadsides or riptides, etc. So having a good idea of your win condition will inform you about what resources are expendable. So if you're killing drones, you don't particularly need all your melee units. Like Death Company versus drones, especially if they deploy right and play right, they are actually a sacrifice unit. Like you either sacrifice them on a turn where you want to absorb Overwatch so that your Sandguard can make the connects instead, because the D3 damage on their weapons is a lot better against drones than the single damage is on the Death Company. On top of that, the Sandguard have a lot more staying power in that one with the 2-up save, which will go to a 4-up versus all the neg 2 burst cannons, and the 2 damage, but you have a feel no pain against the 2 damage. So all you need to do is make 1-5. That's a whole another 2 damage shot that's going to be wasted. So things like that, the Death Company all of a sudden become a sacrifice piece. Now, you wouldn't think it, seeing as how big, punchy, and killy they can be, but in that game, they don't have a great role. They don't have a great job that they can do. The best thing they can do is make sure something else, they enable something else to do its job. Now, here's a pretty specific example of what I'm talking about. And this is one that comes to mind a lot. So I played Guard at the WTC, the ETC. And in ETC missions, they have those 3-tiered missions. And this is so much more relevant, I think, for ETC than it might be for ITC, but the same concept applies. So they have the scoring that's based on the Eternal Wars, which is your progressive scoring or your holding objectives at the end of the game. You have points based on Maelstrom cards, and then you have points based on kill points. And now the kill points is usually capped. It's usually got a hard ceiling on the differential. So you can only get a max of 6 points or 8 points either way. When I'm playing Guard, I know I'm pretty much always going to lose on the kill points. So what I need to do is make sure that I outscore them on the Maelstrom to offset the kill points. So that means like I'm willing to give away the full 6 points differential, 8 point differential kill points, as long as I'm one or two up on Maelstrom, because then it's a net gain. Even though I'm throwing away resources, I'm getting absolutely demolished, I'm still net gaining. So a lot of the times, like I'll draw a card and it'll be like secure objective 2. Okay, the other bloke has got like 10 intercessors on secure objective 2. I'm going to double move these unit of infantry and go get 2 guys on secure objective 2 and put all my artillery into those intercessors to clear them off so I hold it at the end of the turn. Those infantry, that guy is going to take that objective straight back off me and kill those infantry straight back next turn. But I was going to give, I'm giving up a kill point. I was probably going to give up anyway. I'm gaining on him on Maelstrom. And so when you think about your resource management, you think about it not in the relation to the bodies on the table, you think about relation to the scoreboard. I suppose that's the next level of this topic and of how deep we go with
it. Well, I mean, like that's, said, everything has to be contributing towards the end, right? The win, the end of winning the game or you're competing, you know, that's what it is. I mean, so you don't want to do this casually without an effort or without that goal in mind.
Yeah, we've got two ways of looking at things in military framework and in similar veins to this, right? And so we talk about, one point is about resources specifically. And we talk about main efforts and we talk about supporting efforts. The main effort is what we commit our resources to ensuring happens, whereas supporting efforts are in a lower priority, so they might not receive the weight of resources behind them in order to make their, they're still important, right? They still lead to success, but ultimately the main effort is what you have to commit your resources to. And so for just an example that I have in regards of the Berserkers is that I've got three squads, but I've got one squad that I know it's going to be able to go into a fight phase. It's going to be able to consolidate and lock in more. It's going to get in contact with some crucial elements, some, you know, the elements of my opponent's army that I want to make sure that they kill. And so in this main effort concept, I'm going to commit, you know, four or even up to six CP to make sure that those 138 point models get everything they can and they have the entire weight that I can afford to put behind them in that resource management concept to make sure that 138 points deals out enough damage to, you know, remove, hopefully in this case, I mean, we're talking well beyond three to, I know as crazy as this sounds, like those 138 point models could destroy well over 600 points plus of other models, right? So
they could drop a knight.
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, I've done it. I watched it happen. Yeah. Knights just vanish, right? And so that's the first part. The second big part to this, and this really goes into what Adam's talking about in regards of like that key point at which victory is almost assured. So we call that the decisive point, right? The decisive point, when you talk about, let's we can go, stop me if I'm not allowed to go this far off, if I jump the shark here, but the you're talking about Star Wars, right? At what point did the Rebels win against the Empire, right? Was it when they stole the Death Star plans? Was it when they dropped the shields? Was it when they actually got into the Death Star? Or, you know, whatever. Which point was, you know, what point was victory assured for the Rebels?
I have the answer. I don't know if that, I know this is partly rhetorical and just for illustration.
No, go for it. I want to hear your, this is a great debating point, but this goes right back into what Adam was talking about of what point is victory assured. What's your answer?
It's when Han came back.
So Han was definitely a shaping effort, and because he made sure that Luke could get to that point, right? That Luke could get there to actually get the torpedo into the shaft to destroy them getting to the Death Star. You got to think about all the logistics that got him there and everything like that. Essentially, once they were committed and they had the forces to the point where they could drop that in, victory was assured, right? All they had to do was just get that in and then do that. There were so many other little things that played into it. That's kind of the point in this in regards of recognizing where that decisive point is in any tactical scenario and being able to make sure, again, going back to the main effort and the supporting efforts, that your main effort is given what it needs to, in order to get to this decisive point. Now, it doesn't necessarily always have to be that exact effort. That's where we go back to the redundancy point. You've got alternates, you've got supplements, you've got other things available.
And to be more serious and not just goofy because I like talking about silly parts of Star Wars, is that we can look back at that with perfect information. We can look in the history with the perfect information. And we're going to debate of what the when it is, but we can at least be looking at all the same facts. When you're on the tabletop playing in real time, you may not you have to maybe make a little bit of a gut check and draw on past experience, of course. But, you know, you've got to look at it and analyze it almost like a, you know, in a very real time situation.
Absolutely. And so that continuing with that, because you're right, it's a judgment call, right? That's really these tactical decision games. That's what it is. I mean, you're making decisions, you're maneuvering pieces. Judgment is something that between intuition and experience is developed over time. Like, if you didn't know what you're going into, you don't know your army or you don't know your opponent's army, how much more difficult is it to make that judgment call at where the decisive point is and what you need to do going forward into it, right?
Yeah, that's a great points, man.
And you won a lot of hearts and minds with your Star Wars.
I mean the Star Wars thing, it's an awesome teaching point of whether, yeah. I mean, you can even do the reverse edge of, like, at what point did the Empire take Hoth, right? I mean, there's, again, it just goes into when you're looking at all of these different aspects for what is the decisive point, and understanding that there's a decisive operation, it's not necessarily about who is the most important at that point. It's what needs to be done and who can achieve that. It's the decisive operation.
If we can talk about going back into the, you know, now in the early, you know, I guess ancient history of the game of 8th edition with the Castellan. Mm-hmm. You knew that you had to commit. You had to absolutely commit to take it down, or you're going to be in a situation where all your efforts are going to be wasted because it could act as full and whatever. Like, you take out two or three things of your stuff. And so you had to commit to it. And people had to make some probably questionable decisions about what they were going to fire at that thing to get its final few wounds off, how they were going to layer their attacks to chip away at it if they didn't have things that could deliver those huge punches.
And I suppose that bleeds into, I suppose that the best armies, like, that we've had in this edition are things that force the win condition upon your opponent. Like, you show up and you, like, the way this army is built, I know exactly what you need to do to beat me. And therefore, I can stop you. I can manage my resources to such an extent that I can deny you doing what you want. I suppose that, like you said before, the Leviathan and the Iron Hands and the Castellan are a perfect example of this. Like, the Castellan is. If the Castellan is still there at turn four, you're probably screwed. Like, more likely than not, you're absolutely stuffed. ergo, the same thing happens with, like, a Taoist, like the Richard Siegel Taoist. If he makes it to the middle objectives, to the, like, the two or three middle objectives with, like, 30 drones left, you're probably stuffed. Yeah. Now, there's a lot of intricacy and minutiae in discovering what that is, but you can tell, like, whether it's, you know, 28 drones or 32 drones, I mean, who really gives a stuff? It's just, like, the thought in your head of having the goal and Red said, just the clarity of expectation and what you're required to achieve.
It's like an hourglass. The sand is ticking away, and you just don't, if you can't get your where you need to be before the time is out on you, then that's almost like the drones. That's almost like a physical representation of the drones.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the easiest way for the numbers and figures and tallies one is kind of the Richard Sager and the Iron Hands list, because there is such a critical mass of a wound and defensiveness and polarization within those lists that there is an easily way of saying, hey, I will have been outscored if I haven't killed all the drones by now, because therefore I won't have enough time to get through the riptides. But there is things as just as simple as, like, oh, if I let him hold three objectives, I lose. That's just things as simple as that. Yeah, if he holds three objectives for three turns, I've lost. I'm going to get outscored. I don't have enough time. I don't have enough turns left to get the score back. And not all of them are score-based, not all of them are turn-based, especially when you have ways of mitigating the loss of your resources. Now, a good way, so I talked about the pillars of resource management, especially when it comes to 40K. And the one I touched on was, like, having one thing that is really good at doing what it does. And you have ways and means of letting it do what it does consistently. Now, of course, the Castellan was a very good example of this. It was very good at picking up vehicles, and it was very hard to kill four vehicles because the 3+ involved and all the other insane stuff. Maybe it's Tyrannus and you get back up and all that good stuff. A lot of other good ways is leaving stuff off the board, or outflanking it, or et cetera, or keeping it out of line of sight. Like, I know paladins have now become one of the fire and fade mechanic that they've got, where they shoot in the movement phase, so shoot in the psyche phase, and then move back, outflanking tank commanders, or deep striking sanguinary bombs, or bloodletter bombs, things like that. When you have a good way of making sure that the resource that you've invested your points into, and probably and past that, like, you invested your money and your blood, sweat, and tears into it. So having a good way of making it reliably do what you want it to do is very important for managing your resources. So I keep coming back to Centurions. Like, Centurions can do such a heinous amount of damage, especially when they're coming in from outflank. You don't have a chance to respond to them, to hamper their movement, to roadblock them, to get in the way. So all you can rely upon doing is your positioning. Now, the things that you position to block Centurions from when they're coming off the board are so dead, it's not fun. Like, literally, they're dead. Either they're going to get charged or they're going to get shot until they're gone. Now, a lot of armies don't have the reliability. I think we talked about this before. Don't have things like Nurgle. Don't have things like... I mean, what do the Necrons do, hey? What do your Necrons do to like, where is a not prime resource a Necron can throw away that they don't need later in the game?
I thought you were going to say they just sacrifice everything. They just everything.
Yeah, everything.
No, I mean, that's an excellent point, and what makes currently as it is list building with Necrons, I mean, I'm not going to say that everything's overcosted necessarily, but there is such weight in where you dedicate your points in Necron lists. You don't have, it's definitely not like a guard list when a battalion of Necrons essentially is almost the same amount of points as a brigade of guard.
Yeah, it is more in some cases, just because the amount of points they have to put into their troop choices and characters for the min buy-in.
And then you have to roll nothing but sixes. It's worse.
Yeah.
It gets worse.
Yeah.
But for Necrons, like, what do you do to stop ad-flanking Centurions getting into a prime target? Like, you have to use, then you all of a sudden you have a lot of, you need a lot of very specific resources. So most likely you'll
be that influences fly. Your army build choices. I mean, like, with that in mind.
The resources you decide to take to the battle.
Yeah.
I mean, I can tell for those Necron players out there, Doomsday Arcs and Tesseract Arcs, if Forge World is, you know, allowed in your environment, those are some go-to things in the current meta. I don't mean to, but continue.
Just because they're so large?
So they help. I mean, you can block things out, and they're Tesseract Arcs specifically. So Tesseract Arcs have a -2 to charge. So when it gets to the Centurions making that charge, it makes it less. I know that they have other ways to help get them there, but it helps that. They also have weapons that can help reduce that, and they're tough. And so when something like the Centurions go in there, because how much damage do they do in melee? They do.
Billions.
Yeah, but they do a lot, and so quantum shielding helps. You know, a Necron army can try to endure to an extent with those platforms. So we go back to again the point values and how you have to go about it. You understand that you're going to lose something to some extent. There's too much.
You're buying yourself opportunity. The opportunity cost is your ghost arc, but you have bought that opportunity.
Yeah,
and you bought yourself an opportunity to respond. Yeah, because, like I said, that pillar of resource management, keeping things off the board so they have an opportunity to do what they do. On the reverse of that is planning to throw away resources in order yourself to not lose the game. Because that's exactly what would happen. I never like using guardsmen for this job to zone out things like Centurions, because the savvy player won't shoot them, they'll just come in for a wrap. And then all I've done is given a leapfrog for those Centurions to get even deeper into my lines the next turn. So I don't like using them. So that's where I think, like, you need to consider using things like fly. I mean, the Scarabs are literally probably the only throwaway unit with fly that Necrons have. They're the only unit you can reliably use to screen something out because they can't be wrapped because they got fly. It's a strain, like, they're almost too expensive to be doing that with, but it's like a necessity. And yet, like, you think about armies like Chaos, yeah? So Nurglings are a very good example of this, because you can infiltrate Nurglings out and then put something 18 inches behind the Nurglings, e.g. nothing can deep strike between the Nurglings and the next thing behind them. If they wrap the Nurglings and they're 18 inches away from your army when they wrap the Nurglings, you can be like, that's a net gain, I'm just going to piss off and run away. And the Centurions are never going to connect again. So that's causing issues for your opponent, and your opponent's resource management. Do they have the line of sight shooting to kill the Nurglings in the three turns before the Centurions have to come in? It's a huge give and take. It's a massive give and take. And it's one of the biggest facets of the game that I find at the moment. And I this will be the fourth or third or fourth time I come back to this, because everything kills everything.
You're talking like that, but that's the truth. I mean, the concept that everything can wound things and we have high volume of fire is a very shooty specific type of game. I mean, although there are some killer melee units there, everything can kill everything. And that does happen.
Yeah, and apart from like a specific handful of outliers, everyone has the ability to take the right profile of weapons to kill everything, you know? So in some cases, that's spamming strength 5, like Ren 2 guns, as I did with my latest Ravenwing army. I just spammed strength 5 and strength 6 guns. It was pretty much the same as when the edition first came out and everyone was taking like 7 or 8 twin assault cannon razorbacks. It was the same premise. Spam enough of a thing, it'll kill everything. But, you know, Space Marine armies are an exceptionally good army for taking the right amount of each weapon to get a job done. E.g., like, you don't need two grav bombs. You don't need two units of grav devastators in a drop bomb. You just need one, because one is enough to get exactly the right amount of work done for that resource. E.g., you didn't see two Leviathans in an army, because you only have enough defensive options to give one to make it doable. And that one did everything it needed to do anyway, because it was broke as a joke, and you should feel bad.
we've talked a lot about playing defensively. We've talked a lot about playing completely offensively, and we haven't touched on it in this situation about controlling the theater of the conflict.
And this feeds back into the last time Red was on, because Red was talking about a holistic approach to battles, to combat.
Yeah.
So board control, I think, has always been a huge deal one way or the other. I think that with things like infiltrators, again, I go back to them, and like you mentioned, Adam, Nurglings, with things, you know, stealth suits, what have you, or, I mean, even you take this direction from Chapter Approved, and now with ITC, with the whole attacker defender. When it comes down to this element of board control, and we can look back, last time when I talked about breaking down the battlefield between, a forward disruption zone, your main battle area, and the support zone, or your rear, you can look at how are you controlling the different avenues. And so then, you know, you talk about current ITC, and it's the maneuver secondaries, or ETC or WTC. When you talk about Maelstrom and being able to control objectives, it's a little more random in which objectives you necessarily need to control, but at least having the option to even be that far out to control that is huge. And so when you look at we go all the way back to where we're talking about effects, right? And the effects of a unit and what you want to achieve and the momentum of the fight. If you know you're going first and you can keep the opponent in their deployment zone while you score your maneuver secondaries, and by turn three, you have 8 points because you scored all your two maneuver secondaries. And you essentially had the board. You can choose to keep controlling it to a certain extent, understanding that you're being attrited while your opponent's being attrited. You already have that 8-point lead. And so when it comes to board control, whether you're defensive and you understand, okay, I'm going to cede part of the board while I establish the momentum because I endure and then I can come out, kind of like, you know, some of the Siegler lists to certain points. Like, he understands that by turn six, he needs to be kind of back to what you're saying, Adam, the win conditions. He understands he needs to have achieved the win condition at whatever point so that by turn six, he's falling in on X objectives to be able to have this many points. And he won the momentum somewhere between, you know, deployment and determining who the attacker defender was and turn six.
Yep, spot on, dude.
Yeah, I like that a lot. One really good point efficient thing to help is what I consider a sacrifice and also controlling the theater of the conflict is a solitaire and the Harlequins.
Oh, yeah, man. Yep. Anything like that that can be on one point of the board and, you know, Shining Spears, the Harlequin solitaire is so good because he's a missile. He's this one dude that can just go with psychic powers and the stratagem and everything else. His blitz ability, I mean, we're talking 32-inch threat range, right? And so that kind of board control, just understanding that he's going to be somewhere and he might not be targetable and he might not be visible, and then he's going to move and he's going to go almost wherever he wants, and then he's going to find something and he is an effect. You're going to take him and you're going to assassinate something. Yeah. And he might still have the ability to survive after that.
He won't kill, like, well, you can't just run him into 30 boys. 30 boys will absolutely wreck his face. I mean, like, he will kill some boys, but he will not survive the swing back.
Mm.
But anything short of something with 30 wounds and 4 attacks apiece or whatever, he's probably going to pick it up.
Yeah.
Yep. I'd back that.
I mean, outside of, you know, a 24, you know, like a knight, something with 24 plus wounds itself, he's going to have struggle with. But, you know, anything sub that, he's going to be able to run over there and deal with it, which means your opponent will have to account for it. And that means holding resources back to protect things that they don't want to get killed by this guy.
Breaking down into some practical applications. So the podcast I used to run, I used to take listener questions. And one of them was a guy, a Tau player, asking how to deal with Yunari Shining beers, because they would, as a Tau player, they would come in, they would just copy Overwatch or just charge a place where they don't take much Overwatch, and then they would wrap something, kill it, and just go deep in, and he just auto lose the game to one unit of Shining Spears. The advice to him that I gave was to use his Riptides to charge the Shining Spears, so that turning your 3+ involves charge the Shining Spears with your Riptides. So when the Riptides charge the Shining Spears, they're only going to attack by 2 or 3 back, depending on positioning, and they're going to wind you on 5s, and you're going to have a 3+ involve. You're not going to give any stuffs about the damage they do to your back. What you're going to do is you're going to stop them charging deeper into your lines. Now, that doesn't quite work on the solitaire because it can charge from reserve. Sorry, it can charge when it falls back and do whatever it wants. But for things like Death Company, like if you have a spare Rhino or something that has fly, maybe not a Rhino, maybe Rhino's a bad idea, Wave Serpent, Devilfish. Impulses, yeah. Just go in and tap one dude. If that one dude might have 2 or 3 dudes within an inch that can attack you, they're not going to be enough to kill a Repulsor with their only having, 4 or 5 attacks each, and winning on 5s, you get a 3+ save. And then what you're denying them is you're stopping them from going deeper into your lines turn one. You're buying yourself a turn. And you can do some things that don't have fly. Things that have fly are infinitely better, of course. But if you had to and you just had like a freaking Rhino, you would still have to do it. And then at least you have time. Yeah. You have time to maneuver yourself away.
Buying yourself a turn. Picking up a whole turn in this game is essentially money in the bank.
Huge, especially when so much of the game, all the secondaries, all the, especially in ITC missions, and the vast majority of GW missions are all progressive scoring. So turns is where, every turn is where things happen. Whereas, remember in 6th edition and 7th edition, when most of the missions were based on who holds what at the end of the game, you'd play a lot more cagey. You'd be like, okay, well, here's the 1/3 of my army that has to be alive at the end. So they're going to either try and stay in reserve as long as they're possible, stay offside as long as possible, and everything else is going to go play distraction. And then last turn of the game, ha-jum, jump on all the objectives. I used to get so frustrated with Eldar players last edition. Because they'd use Autarchs to try and keep their Sky Runners, or what they're called, the Scat Bikes in reserve as long as possible. And I don't want to be disparaging, but the games weren't ending last edition. Games were taking way too long. And so, games are sometimes ending on turn 3 when the reserves can auto come on. And then they auto come on and move 48 inches from any board edge and take all the objectives. And you're like, I played a fantastic game. I played really well. And then
did progressive objectives. I mean, that's it. I mean, that's why they exist.
That's why they exist, because of stuff like that. Every turn that you are not getting wiped off the table is turning into scoring points.
Well, let me also say, not to stymie any one thing, but to promote interaction, because that's really what we want. We just want an interaction. And that's what we're talking about here, is like, how do you control the interaction or always be positioning yourself? Even if it looks like you're giving something up, how do you try to put that into a positive for you?
I think we've done a pretty good job encapsulating it, but I suppose the resource management, they've got a lot of different tiers. I was talking about the pillars of it, like the in-game pillars of it. But outside the game, you've got your command points, you have your psychic powers that you choose before the game, you have your warlord traits, you have your actual points that you use in your army, like the points that you spend. Like all these things, all those four things and many more are like the actual resources that you have. And any one of those choices can swing a game. Like I'm looking at Scions right now. Like I have a pretty psychic heavy meta at times in Australia, where we have a lot of psychic heavy Eldar, psychic heavy Chaos, psychic heavy Xenos, like Tyranids. And the Scions specialist attachment has a warlord trait, or I think it's a relic, where you can make a guy have a 2+ deny a psychic power just doesn't work on him. And then there's a Gorgon's warlord trait, the psychic awakening, that makes people perils on any doubles when roll in 24-inch range. And so just like the resources of having the choices to pick those at the start of a game or start of an event goes a huge way. Even the little choices, the little ones, shape how you're going to do in that event or shape how you're going to do in a game. I suppose that could come back to a lot of the logistics of actual combat.
We've kind of danced into the fact that there's some armies don't have these ways to automatically flip this during real time situations, and so you have to prepare for it. Like I need some tools in my toolbox. I need to come with that, and then like Necrons, we're talking about, for instance. But armies like Demons and Marines, have it all day long, have options available to them just by the nature of building one of their list.
I suppose it's a real difference. I wrote a list the other day that had started with 6 command points and spent every single one of them pre-game.
Yeah.
I started the game with 0 command points.
That's a champion.
Because I just want to see it.
That's the way some of my Eldar lists worked. Like, okay, how many you start the game with? Well, I start with 7 and now I'll begin the game with 2.
Yeah. And that's because I would rather have the customization pre-game to customize to my opponent than customize in-game on the fly. Yeah. I'd rather start with a cohesive plan and all the counters and all the best strategies and tactics built into my list from the onset of a game, than try and question myself during the game about whether ifs or nots or maybes or whatever.
That's a very good point. Well, gentlemen, thanks for walking through this thought exercise with me. And I know it's going to no doubt spawn more discussions. And I would like to hear how other people are tackling this out there in their games and their current army builds. Let's take a quick break, then we'll come back and talk about some Black Legion army builds.
Sweet.
See y'all in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games, Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey, everybody, we are back. Still got Adam and Red here.
I'm still Adam.
Yeah. So as promised, I got a message today. Actually, I was talking to my buddy on the phone. I know a real phone call. I don't know who does that. Oh, to old people. That's what we do.
I'm outraged. Okay, Boomer.
But he's like, yo, man, I want to get back into the game. What do I need to start with? What do I need to do? You know, and he loves Black Legion. And he's always been a fan since the very, very early days of 40K, of this the theme of the Black Legion, how it's all the chaos at once, led by a very powerful figure. He also likes the fact that I really like Blood Angels and Horus killed Sanguinius. It's part of what he likes.
Killed him dead.
But that's okay.
So I don't know if anybody's read the ADB books, The Talon of Horus and then the Black Legion.
They are fantastic.
Novel. Yeah.
They are superb, and you should jump on them if you can. But I love the mystique around The Talon of Horus, the fact that it's got both the Emperor and a Primarch's blood on it, and how everyone's like reverent of it because of this fact. And I love it. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, it's phenomenal books. The fact that they take place after the Heresy, before the, you know, it's really neat.
After the Heresy, before the first Black Crusade, the first Foul Crusade, I should say.
Yep. So check those out. So I asked him very blatantly, you know, like what is attracting you to the army? Is there anything in he has no idea. He actually doesn't. He's not making model based decisions at this point. He is just wants to play and be involved in the lore and the activity, which is cool, good enough, right?
So yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, how would I build a Black Legion list right now?
So I one thing I love about Black Legion is that it's still a legion. Like when you look at it, it's a conglomeration of warbands. Like there is the Slaanesh warband, there's the Nurgle warband, there's the Khorne warband in the Hounds of Abaddon, and there's all of them in there and a million more. So you could fluff wise, lore wise, you could literally do whatever you want within this one sub faction of a faction. So it's really like, it's a really wide, wide thing for him, especially modeling wise. Like I really wanted to do, you know, Bloodsecrators or the Blood Warriors or whatever from Age of Sigmar. I always wanted to paint some of those Black Legion to be the Hounds of Abaddon, the Khorne Berserkers of Abaddon.
Oh, yeah.
Because I just thought those models would look superb. And they're a bit more beefcake and a bit more dynamic. And, of course, they're not like, you know, 25 years old as the current Berserker models are, G-dubbed. Like the models, I don't think the models have ever been better for Chaos. The Chaos models are fantastic. The Chaos Space Marines are superb.
Well, what they've done is low key scaled them up too. Like the Chaos Space Marines are the exact same size as Primaris Marines, give or take. You know,
they look great.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I've got a love hate with the Oblitz. Some of the, like, there's one. I think there's only two Obliterator Sculpts, but they're pretty modular. But there's some people build them, and that's just not to my taste. And some people build them and go, oof.
Well, the only way to get obliterators right now is from some of the box sets. Like you can't buy obliterators on their own in the newest design, the new plastic ones.
Correct.
Well, and you, when you told me about this topic, I had a quick look at this Chaos Space Marines up on the web store, and I just wanted to see, like, you know, what you could buy. So you can't buy Venom Crawlers. You can't buy the Masters. Is the Master of Possession the guy with the goat head?
Yeah.
Yes.
And you can't buy the Big Possessed? Who are the big character possessed guys?
The Greater Possessed.
Those are all models.
Yeah, they're
freaking
awesome.
Amazing. They're actually ridiculously great, but you can't buy them. But that Star Collecting box is like $95 American. If you wanted to buy just the 10 Chaos Space Marine Marines from that box, it's $60 American. So you're paying $35 for a Venom Crawler, two Obliterators, and essentially three characters, which all could be valued at like $30 each.
That's
a really good value, really good value for a starting point. Like getting two or three of those, like you've got 30 Marines, six Oblitz, which is probably the sweet spot for Oblitz, 2-3. And you probably wouldn't need, like, I haven't seen anybody using 3-3. I have seen 2-3, 1-3. And Venom Crawlers, they're all right. stats. I've yet to see one
competitively, but you know, even if you just put that, you could throw that in the trash, you're still up on value.
you're still up on value. On top of that, there would be an amazing way to convert and customize other kits like Morlafiends, Disco Lords, Helldrakes, things like that. Or just get three of them, put them together, and just make a better defiler.
Or some for God's sake, give them a new
defiler. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And also the Abaddon model is actually like, do I want to say the word perfect? I'm not sure if I want to say the word perfect.
But let's start there for a second. In this Black Legion army, do you even take Abaddon?
That's a great question, because it really depends on what you're going for, right? I've told a lot of people this in regards of going into playing 40K. Do you want to have a good time? And I don't mean to make this sound too rough, but do you want to have a good time? And then number two is, do you want to have a good time and win? Right? And I'm not trying to be too critical, and I'm not saying that Abaddon is one way or the other specifically, but when it comes down to it, like, you could make an awesome looking, going back to like the AVB books and you talk about, you know, everything that goes into the Black Legion, you could make a Black Legion list that has a squad of Rubric Marines that still have, I mean, there's some competitive play with a squad of Rubric Marines right now, right? You could still bring in a squad of Berserkers that are Black Legion that, I mean, I think that there's other things that can be brought in, say from Faith and Fury and whatnot with Chaos Space Marines, that maybe it's more worth it that they're Alpha Legion or they're, but if you're going purely Black Legion here, you got to realize that you're kind of, you're, there are certain advantages that are being ceded by going pure Black Legion, right?
That was part of the conversation I had with him. Like, you sure you don't want to play Alpha Legion? You sure I can't put you in an Alpha Legion right now?
Well, I mean, and that's the beauty of three detachments, is that technically there could be some of that in there, you know?
I think that Black Legion have one of the best, like, so you got stratagems and you got, you know, roller traits and stuff, and you got stuff in the very high ultra competitive range, you got stuff in the very low uncompetitive range, and you got a lot of stuff in the middle. I feel like Black Legion has a very good density of things in the middle. And like, from what I know, they've only got one ultra crazy, possibly game winning strategy. That being like, I think the World Burners or whatever it is. We'll probably get to that later. But the key to them, I believe, is the fact that they could do a lot of decent things. They're not Alpha Legion, which they can do crazy infiltrators and make things untargetable. They're not Night Lords, where they can make super smash captains and bikers and terminators that will shoot and do all the crazy stuff. Or like, Flawless Host, where you can make crazy good Disco Lords and things like that.
Well, can't you still take whatever mark you want, like on whatever units? So, I mean, you can still take Slaanesh Obliterators, right?
Absolutely right. You can shoot them.
Right, yeah. So you can, yeah, exactly. You're not hindered. There's a lot of flexibility to it. You're not hindered. You could make a Slaanesh Obliterators. There's also the Black Legion have that stratagem to be able to add all the marks at one time, so that you can play into a lot of these stratagems. They also, I mean, Chaos Space Marines, I can't remember if it's Black Legion specific, but there's a way to take an unmarked squad and then later dedicate them to whatever you want to, you know, there's a lot of flexibility into it.
First one you were talking about is the Chosen of the Pantheon uses stratagem to pick a Black Legion unit from your army with the Mark of Chaos keyword that you did not dedicate to a specific dark god. The unit has all four of them until the start of your next turn.
See, exactly. And so you could make, let's say it was a squad of Terminators, you could make them shoot twice, and then they could fight again at the end of the fight phase, depending on what they're getting into. And then you can go into, you talk about the stratagem that Adam mentioned, the World Burners. I think that's the one where you're counted for dealing extra casualties, if I'm...
No, that's...
You talk about the OPSEC one, the World Killers one?
Oh, the
World Killers, yeah.
Oh, yeah,
That's like their one genuine game-winning stratagem. Use the beginning of a battle round, turn off your opponent's OPSEC. It's gone for the battle round.
Right.
It's just not there. Like, if you're playing like Eternal War, last turn of the game objectives, like, tell me that's not game winning in the right hand. Like, when you use it properly, tell me that's not crazy.
Yeah,
you're right. I mean, that's even major board control influence.
It's 3 CP, but still, if it wins the game, who cares how many CP it is?
That's right.
And on the same thing, you think about the applications in, let's say, ITC, just speaking about ITC. So that's, you may not have been able to get a hold. And now you get up 3 CP, you get a hold. You may be on 3 objectives and they're contesting 2 of them. You turn up their OPSEC and now you're holding 3 objectives. So you get hold more. Maybe that means you get a bonus point. And so for 3 CP, you can get 3 points. In ITC, that's huge. That is huge because those 3 points you took are 3 points your opponent can't get. So that's that can be at times a five-point swing in the state of the game. So for 3 points, getting a five-point swing in my direction, superb. Would do yeah. every time.
Yeah. Well, and so going forward to back to Abaddon specifically, when you consider what he does and the effects that he grants in regards of the army writ large, I mean, 12-inch fearless bubble.
That's
right?
Massive.
That's massive, right? 12-inch.
Yeah.
What how big is his base? Is he on a 40 or a 50 mil?
He's on the Gilliman base.
Yeah, it's like a 60 millimeter.
60, it's a 60. Yeah. Yeah, 60. So then,
That's a legitimate quarter of the board. Sorry, keep going.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And so then you consider you can surround, and that's not just Black Legion. That's any Chaos Space Marine units are fearless.
Heretic Astartes.
Heretic Astartes.
Just in case there's a keyword or whatever. I just don't want.
Well, and so you're talking about cultists. You're talking about whatever. I mean, they're fearless within 12 inches. So really, 12 inches, 24 inches, left or right, right, all together. And so to be able to put him in the middle of the board and say, you have to kill every single one of these cultists that I've just put in front of you to get rid of it. And then not only that, but so I was doing something still, with Abaddon. This was, over a year ago, before the Necron, my wave of Necrons, I was using almost 20-man units of Berserkers, and they were Alpha Legion, but I had Abaddon behind them, and his 12-inch fearless bubble was going into these massive units of Berserkers. So they were going to withstand it unless you killed them to the man. Not only that, but then so coring into Black Legion more specifically, he has a 6-inch aura that allows to reroll all hits. It's not just failed hits or whatever, but reroll all hits for Black Legion. And so that's where we talk about the obliterators. We talk about, he's an excellent support unit that can really enhance an army. Sure, he's 200 plus points, I think. But
well, he's also a goalie, so nobody, you may have some kind of dirtly, things that you just need to shoot, over there. But you might take a fat unit of cultists or whatever that are just holding down that backfield objective, and then I know we say everything kills everything, but not everybody's got quite enough shots to dig out cultists and cover.
Right.
Or the point is, do you want to? Don't you have? You might have Havocs to shoot. You might have Disco Lord. You might have Forge Fiends and Hell. Who wants to be putting their guns into cultists when you've got things that are infinitely more dangerous? But yet the cultists are the thing that might be there at the end and win you the game.
So dipping a little more into the fluff side of, going into it saying, well, I just want to have a good time. It's not the most competitive build, but I do say something I really enjoyed is I've got Abaddon, and I went and I got from the Horus Heresy series from Forge World, I got 10 of the Justeran Terminators.
Nice.
And so I gave them the combi plasmas, and then they've got, now they're sporting chain axes, which came out in the most recent version of, and so when you look at it, that is a significant point investment. We talked about some of the earlier stuff we talked in the previous session in regards of how many points. That's a lot of points into a 10-man Terminator squad. But when you consider from the lore and what Abaddon looks like at this point in 40K, and you put that man on the table, and then you put his Justeran Terminators right next to him, and they're in their glossy black and red armor with their top knots on top of their Terminator. It just looks awesome. And that's still a unit with combi plasmas. Let's say their Mark of Slaanesh or what have you, that they can still put a sizable amount of firepower down, especially taking it to the next point, that awesome, what I love about Black Legion is that Council of Traitors stratagem, which for one CP, you essentially get to give, so let's say you got Abaddon as your Chaos Lord, you got an Apostle, and you got a Sorcerer, all three of them get a Warlord trait. Love it.
Oh, that's
yeah,
that's,
I like it a lot.
It's not bad.
So some people complain with Chaos that cultists, they're not that cheap what you get, or you only get five of them, or they're not very...
You're saying people were complaining that they weren't worth it, they weren't good enough?
Well, then they're not killing anything.
To be fair, so they're 4 points per model now. They don't get the Legion benefits, which, that's unfortunate, but at the same time, when you throw up, I think they can be 40 per squad, and then you have the Tide of Traitors stratagem to be able to bring them back into it. They're going to survive maybe unless someone really puts in the weight on it. But if you've got Abaddon over there, they're still there. It's a 3-man squad. It goes from 40 to 3 models that are now hidden behind a wall or what have you. And then you tie to traitors and suddenly you've got 40 more cultists on the table.
Well, I don't know that you want to spend $1 billion on them, but, you know, tying back to our early topic about resource management, you kind of have to do that threat assessment. Like, how many will I effectively lose? Like, am I winning the game if I've somehow duped my opponent into shooting at them, you know, this unit?
And yeah.
I mean, dupe is a bad word, like, because sometimes it is absolutely the right thing to do to kill those things. But what cost is your opponent sacrificing to have to do it?
Yeah, I mean, it's still 40 of them is still, what, 160 points?
They're 4 points apiece, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, 40 of them, 160 points. That, if you've got to dig that out and you spend 400 points just to kill 160 points, I mean, that Black Legion player has made a win in that situation.
The other thing that's real going for the Black Legion is the relics, man. This the was it Gorsevec's Teeth, which is that chain sword that does mortal wounds on sixes?
Mm-hmm.
And you get 2 extra attacks and it's damage too. I know, like taking a Chaos Lord and Abaddon are not exclusive things. Like you can easily, you could do both, but we're talking about if you're going to take Abaddon, if your points, if you need a bunch of stuff, if you're not building that kind of hangout and tanky, army, you know, kind of not a gun line, but you don't care about his big mega bubble. Then maybe you go with more like precision things, like, chain that you hear about the Chain Lord. This comes from a Black Legion Chaos Lord with 2 chainswords and a jump pack and running around buffing himself up with stratagems doing mortal wounds on 4+. Oh, is it 2 mortal wounds apiece on 4+ plus the damage of the weapon?
So he's, because on top of that, he's also got the Warlord trait.
Yeah,
exactly right.
There is a lot going for Black Legion. Now, what we were talking about earlier is multiple detachments. What you've seen Black Legion make itself, its way into people's armies as one of your detachments. And this is focused more on building an entire army out of Black Legion.
Mm. Now, so is he dedicated to just playing the actual Black Legion, or is he in love with the fluff and the feel and the thematics of the story? Because you could, theoretically, you could paint your army as Black Legion and play as a warband of any faction. Like, you could play it.
See, you just crossed the line, my friend. You're on a slippery slope. You know, by the time we're done, we're not talking about Black Legion anymore. Now, look, I'm with you, man. Like, I think sometimes you need a story to influence your build, and sometimes your build needs to influence your story. And it's all, there's room for that in 40K, no matter what, not shaming anybody one way or the other. I just know that he would not be down for that. And we all know people that are like that.
Well, so the idea was, so the Talon of Horus story follows a Thousand Sun Psyker. And he's Rube Riquet, and he's trying to get his friends back and his comrades back from the Curse of Dust or whatever it is. Now, it follows him as the main character, not Abaddon, not any of those guys. And so you take it on his tour, and his warband becomes part of the Black Legion. So he has black-painted Rube Riquet, which I think would look superb, by the way.
Well, you can still have the Rubric Marines in the list.
Well, what I was going to say is, would you be against people having black painted Rubrique, Black Legion themed Rubrique, and use the Thousand Suns Codex for their rules?
I would not, but let me just play him. Yes.
Okay, fair enough. Because that was my idea. I was like, I want a hugely fleshed out. I want, when I had aspirations, when I was reading Talon of Horus books, because that's really, a lot of the time when I don't have a main cohesive competitive army, I will just like be led by the nose by fluff points that I like and enjoy.
Yeah.
And so I was reading those Talon of Horus books and the Black Legion one. I was like, holy crap, I want to do a 10,000 point Black Legion. I'm going to do 2,000 point list of the Hounds of Abaddon, and I can use World Eaters rules because it makes the most sense. Thing is, there's nothing, because Black Legion is all encompassing. I can make a 2,000 point list of Thousand Suns, and I can either use Thousand Suns or Black Legion, and same for Death Guard or Black Legion. And it would all be thematic. It would all look as one cohesive, you know, ash black painted army, and play very differently depending on what I want to do. And the last 2,000 points was just going to be Abaddon and the Justerian. So Abaddon and like 2,000 points of like obliterators and sorry no so 2,000 points of terminators and sorcerers and demon princes.
That's nice.
I just thought that would be the coolest thing ever, using all the 30k
a lot more armies like that in like third and fourth edition, where they would be painted whatever and then have the shoulder pad that's the Legion specific shoulder pad. There was a lot of that. Or they were, you know, painted in Black Legion with a bright colored shoulder pad for whatever it is that marked their mark of chaos for their whatever color, yeah, exactly, pink, right, green or blue or whatever.
Yeah, to that point, I mean, the stuff that came out in the Psychic Awakening book recently for the Rubric Marines, that goes back to it. I mean, there's still some of those stratagems that came out. They don't say Thousand Suns Rubric Marines. They just say Rubric Marines. Now, that does require you to have a detachment of Thousand Suns, right? How many Chaos Space Marine armies have we seen that have a Supreme Command detachment of Ahriman plus, you know, whatever? And so there's nothing saying that, you know, you couldn't still do that to this point. I do think that there's a lot to build on with those Rubric Marines.
The Black Legion, they also get access to the absolute veterans of the Long War killer stratagem. That thing is just, it's a math-breaking, you know, encounter buster, really, is what it is.
It's huge. I mean, +1 to wound.
The value goes up exponentially on some of the units that you use that double shoot. Like, you got obliterators that double shoot. You paid 1 CP to get twice the value out of that, but twice the +1 to wound. Same things with Ghost of, like, using on a little Discord that has, like, just an actual, like, ladle bucket of attacks. You know, the more attacks you get using that stratagem, the more effect that it has. The Berserkers are another good point, like, because you have so many freaking attacks and you can attack 3 times with the Berserkers, that 1 CP becomes exponential increase in damage output because it's across so many variables.
It's it's demoralizing when your opponent uses it. So use it as often as you can.
Judiciously. It's still the best stratagem that Chaos has available to them. In my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it just ratchets that damage up. I mean, and then it triggers off these other things. So if there's anything that triggers off a regular number that doesn't say an unmodified number, then it counts.
Yeah.
And so that's, you get some explosive turns out of it. So Black Legion get access to that. That's where I'm saying. So there isn't much that they're not getting access to if you choose one of these things, other than deployment shenanigans. And that's what's been winning a lot of the games, which is why Alpha Legion is, in my opinion, so beef.
Yeah.
100%. I mean, how game-breaking was it for the 3 months when you could deploy 60 Alpha Legion Berserkers 9 inches away from your opponent's deployment zone?
It was longer than 3 months.
Yeah.
Am I going first or are you going first, mate? Let's find out, because one of us is getting stumped.
Well, and that was the thing, man, right? So, I mean, it was definitely longer than 3 months. I was playing that for a hot minute, and then putting Avalon in there, I mean, all I had to do was make sure that he started, you know, you take like Dawn of War or whatever, I could push those guys 9 inches away from you, but with 20 Berserkers, let's say I had 60 Berserkers on the field, I could Congo line them back to easily be within the 12-inch bubble from Abaddon. And so even if you were going first, you had 60 Berserkers that were fearless that you needed to chew through just before I even got to start.
And I think this is the fifth time I'm coming back to this, but I think that's when I noticed the game was so killy, because I play against that guy.
Did you just have a bad game recently where you lost a lot of models? What's going on? No, let's talk about this for a second.
I think that's when I figured it out, because I played against people who were doing that with Berserkers, and then I'm playing against other people who were doing the same thing with Gene Steals. And I noticed that even if I went first, and let's say I killed 45 out of 60, 15 Zerkers was enough to run absolute roughshod over my army unchecked. Like, you only needed 15 to 20 of them out of the 60 you had on the front.
Like, exactly. I played against a list of, it was 4 Storm Surges, and he went first, and he killed exactly that, almost 40 Berserkers, and then that one squad of Berserkers killed 3 Storm Surges in one turn.
That's tragic.
Yeah, man. Exactly.
I mentioned that they were missing out on just the deployment thing. It's also the -1 to hit. So those are very powerful abilities that draw you to things like the Alpha Legion that may shy you away from the Black Legion. But I think this is one of those, I don't want to say it's an untapped faction because people are playing them, but it's an untapped army that still gets the benefit of some of these other powerful stratagems that you just need a little bit of luck for.
100%. Of course, I don't think you're quite playing on hard mode or like super, super hardcore mode. I think that's still reserved for a couple of the other, well, it's probably Space Wolves is the expert mode army right now, unbuffed, Psychic Awakening Space Wolves. But you're certainly not playing on easy mode. I think no one can say that playing Black Legion is playing on easy mode.
Well, we haven't talked about the Dark Apostles and stuff. I mean, there's these other little layers of things that you can dish out. Now, the Possessed, you still get access to the Possessed, but you don't have all the tricks that make them, you know, the killy stuff. I might shy away from the Possessed strategy with the Black Legion.
Yep.
Yeah, so I think that there's probably some play in regards of the Possessed. Of, you know, you talk about the Master of Possession. We go back to the value box of this, the getting started set and Master of Possession. But I still think to kind of help that along, I've been a big fan of incorporating a daemon detachment to help provide some of the loci bonuses that they get. So like, for example, you know, Slaanesh allows you to advance and charge. It's definitely much more difficult in regards of using a possessed bomb that you can't Alpha Legion forward or something like that. But at the same time, giving them something like advancing and charging is pretty big. I mean, you've still got warp time, presumably.
Could Black Legion still make them -2 to hit?
So between a Dark Apostle and you, so they could still be Black Legion. You would need to bring, I think it's a Nurgle demon to be able to cast that, and then plus the Apostle -1 to hit. So you can still make a -2.
Yeah, so you just mark him as Nurgle, and then you put Miasma on him for second -2.
Yep.
Yeah.
See, now we're getting somewhere. Now we're back into the, like, how can I actually build this guy a list and feel good about it should he choose to go out and play the world? I told him, actually I eased him. I'm like, look, man, you know, just pick something you like, and then we can play some narrative games. That's what I told him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, like, what's not narrative about Black Legion having some demons alongside him? Right? Like, that's still totally within the realm of narrative. There's still plenty of ways. I still think that's kind of the benefit of Black Legion. Like you guys were saying before, in regards to his army, you can just incorporate almost whatever and say, well, Abaddon told me I had to show up. So
he was the point of like, just tell me how much it costs. Like, just let me know what I need to buy. I'm like, dude, you don't have to. He hasn't rolled dice in a decade or whatever. I'm like, look, there's a lot, you know, that can go into the game now. So, you know, really, but he didn't care about that. Or I shouldn't say he didn't care about that. That's not his primary concern. He just wants to get back in and have a good time with it and capture some of that lore nostalgia. So that's why I'm focused on building this single faction list for him. But, you know, I don't see him going out and playing in tournaments, but even the most casual gamer wants to win some games. And that's why I thought this was a good conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. I don't know if this is unanimous across the board, but I feel like I could speak for the vast majority of gamers in saying that we just want to have a chance. Like, we don't need to win. Like, winning's not a prerogative all the time, but just feeling like we had a chance is. I know that's certainly how I feel. I never like going into a game feeling like, wow, I have to endure a 3-hour game where I don't have a shot. That's painful.
That's exactly right. You want to feel like you've invested your time at least in something enjoyable or whatever with a positive outcome. Well, guys, let's go ahead and wrap this up. I really appreciate y'all taking the time and talking with me today. Please remember, everybody out there, please like, share, subscribe, check out our sponsors and everything else. It means a lot to us.
And I'm enjoying the absolute hell out of this. It's a great chat.
Yeah, it's really appreciate the conversation. It's been awesome. Only thing I want to tag on, just for those people, you know, Paul, we talked some about the U.S. Army esports team. Application period is closed for anybody that was interested in joining. I appreciate all the applications. We are reviewing them now. Unfortunately, it was down and out last week, and so I'm catching up. But that process is underway, and we look forward to reaching out to people to continue. We're going to do some interviews and talk to some folks. So if you applied for the Army esports program for the Warhammer 40K team, appreciate the application, and I look forward to talking to you in the future. Thanks, Paul.
Heck yeah. You guys have a good night.
Take care.
Corner.